Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cinema Faith Podcast for October 2016. I'm your host, Jonathan Butrin, and I am joined once again by the king of texting, Mr. Tim Nelson.
Oh, man.
I always love getting texts from Tim because he has this way about him. He's very succinct. He'll just give you a line, just like explode you with a line in your phone, and you're like, oh, wow, I got to think about that for a second, right? I'm always really wordy with my texts. They're like emails. I'm like, you know, proper punctuation and spaces and everything. You just hit me with a line.
It's called laziness. That's what that is, John.
Awesome. And sometimes Tim even texts in church.
Hey, easy.
One time. One time recently, we were going to the same church together, and it was my birthday, and Tim saw me across the room, and he texted me happy birthday, which is fantastic, and we started texting about the film we're going to be talking about today, and the best part was our pastor was like, you know, trying to calm everyone down, and he's like, opens it up for prayer, bows his head, I'm getting into prayer mode, I'm closing my eyes, and suddenly my pocket, Tim like sends me three texts about this movie that we're talking about today, and
I didn't realize that happened. I'm sorry.
It was amazing.
To our pastor, I apologize.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
All right. The reason we were texting each other was because we were excited. At that point, we had not seen this movie, and we have finally seen it. And the movie we're going to be talking about today is Birth of a Nation. So, I've been excited about this one for a long time, ever since I read a report from the Toronto Film Festival that this got a standing ovation. Like, people went crazy over this movie on the festivals, and there was just a lot of people that thought this was going to be the movie of the year. That I heard from a couple film people I follow that, like, you can mark it down on your calendar right now, this baby's going all the way through the Oscars, Best Picture, and so I've been excited to see it, and I was really glad that it finally came to theaters and we can talk about it, but unfortunately, that was then, and then this is now. The film was in the news for more than just what happened in the festivals, and that is kind of the 900-pound elephant in the room that we have to get out of the way here. So the writer, director, and star of this film is Nate Parker, and he is a guy about 20 years ago, when he was in college, what was brought to light was that there was a friend had a sexual encounter with a girl that they claimed was consensual and she claimed was not consensual, and they were brought to court with rape allegations, and Nate Parker was acquitted. His friend did serve some jail time, and then he appealed it, and he was later acquitted as well, and then, to make matters worse, the woman committed suicide in 2005. So that's kind of what came to light in the last 3 or 4 months, and it's kind of cast this shadow over the movie. It's in most of the reviews I read, they talked about it, and it's just kind of attached to the movie now. And it kind of raises an interesting question that I think I've thought about before this, just with, you know, there's been a lot of filmmakers and artists that have had some kind of controversial things in their life. Like, if you think about Roman Polanski, Woody Allen, even from a acting standpoint, you know, Tom Cruise, when he kind of had that period where he was jumping on the couch with Oprah and fighting Matt Lauer on Today Show and everything, right? There's a point.
Yeah, that's not a sexual assault.
Right. Yeah, no. Yeah, I'm sorry. Right. Yeah. No, you're right.
But I hear, but Polanski's would be considered, like, right, you know, in that same kind of era, place. And same with Woody Allen.
Yes. So it raises a question of how much should a person's, an artist's personal life affect their work? And so what would you say to that question, Tim?
You're saying, like, should we take the film without considering,
correct,
Parker's background?
Should a person's, what happens in an artist's personal life affect your decision to see a film, to support a film, et cetera?
I think that's up to, yeah, I think you could definitely, yeah. I mean, first off, let me be clear. Like, yep, he was acquitted of this.
He was.
And so I think, you know, I want to take that seriously. You know, he went to court. Mm-hmm. So let's take that seriously. Now, he would say that, you know, he, in interviews, said, well, something immoral did occur. But he won't say, I don't think he said more than that.
And he admitted he was immature back then, but yeah, but he does reference the fact that he was cleared of his charges and wrongfully accused.
Right. I think what I've read from why this is such a big deal is because within the film, there one of the devices he uses is rape in order to kind of make the film move. And he uses and he uses rape twice in this, and neither one of those were like historically accurate.
Hmm.
And so I think that's why this is such a difficult thing to separate, because that because rape is at the heart of this film.
Yeah, and even the one of the actresses who plays the lead, his wife in the film, had her own struggles with an encounter, a rape encounter. And so it was difficult for her to learn the news, which happened, of course, after they filmed it. So, yeah, I mean, I've always sort of advocated keeping an artist's work separate. I think that, but it's difficult. I mean, I get it. Like, it's easy to say that when you're removed from the situation. I could definitely imagine someone who has experienced something like that, or even is involved in the inner circle, to for that to be extremely difficult to see, you know, someone up on screen and to support that. But I guess just from someone who hasn't gone through that, I've always sort of almost had a postmodern approach to film, in the sense that I think that one of the beautiful things about art is the way that it speaks to different people. Like there's basically a different interpretation with every viewing, because we bring our life experiences to the table. We bring so much to each work that we encounter. And so I feel like it almost, to me, I don't love hearing what the artist intended the work to be, what their interpretation of it is, because I just feel like it becomes a distraction. I would rather just take that 2 hours or that painting or that book and take it for what it is and let it have a life of its own, which kind of, to me, is the power of art.
It's interesting, though, because mm-hmm. I remember going in, going in Chicago and going, it was at Art Institute, and looking, there was a Picasso exhibit. And I remember going in there, and there's this time period where he is having these affairs, and he's having these affairs, and he feels like he can't stop himself from having all these affairs. Now, granted, I'm not comparing an affair to an assault. Those, mm-hmm. I'm just telling you, how can we separate these things? And during those times, he has different works that he's like has an animal, like a bull, a lot of times next to a woman. And the idea is that he's this uncontrollable animal that cannot kind of keep it together enough to like not have these affairs. Hmm. And so like it's impacting his, who he is deeply impacting that art. And then how do I look at that art is definitely, I can't look at it apart from his actual life. So I think sometimes it's difficult.
Right.
And I think we have to be aware of the life circumstances, but we also do have to respect the art on its own.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. These are huge questions.
Yes.
I tend to think that, this is a question, right? Would I have viewed this film completely different had I not known Parker's kind of, backstory? I think I would have.
Hmm.
I think I would have looked at this film differently had I not known that. I think everybody knows that, and I think it's having a huge impact on not only ticket sales.
It has, yeah.
But
it's like a 7 million opening weekend, which is terrible. They don't even think it's going to hit the budget.
Yeah, because then they just, the rights were 17.5 million.
Yeah, and it's like 50 million budget on top of that. Yeah.
And so
it's cast a pall over the Oscars. People are saying that it very well might be snubbed altogether. Yeah.
And it's such an important film
mm-hmm.
that it's just a difficult. It's difficult. This is probably one of the more difficult films. Like with the Woody Allen film, I feel like I can because I don't see Woody Allen using like, and I could be wrong. There might be scenes of this in Woody Allen.
I've heard about it
or anything like as like a plot device. But I think in Birth of a Nation, rape is like a major device that's used in order to justify killing. Mm-hmm. And
one difference too is that like both Woody Allen and Roman Polanski were pretty established filmmakers when their controversies were brought to light, right? This is Nate Parker's basically his first foray out of the gate, which is, yeah.
Yeah, and then it gets, we'll talk more about the roots of the title and all that, but it gets, I think this is a big mess for us even kind of venturing in here. It's whole quicksand. And but that's okay. We'll jump in, so, you know, maybe you guys can
forgive us.
Can forgive us or kind of give us some clarity.
Absolutely.
Maybe comment on the website.
Yep. So, now that we've addressed that, let's get into the film itself. I'll give you a brief plot synopsis in case you haven't heard about the movie. You have no idea what it's about. Birth of a Nation is basically a true story about a slave named Nat Turner who grew up and as compared to a lot of slaves, he actually learned how to read at a very young age. And he was given a copy of the Bible, and he grew up sort of learning the Bible inside and out and actually grew into a preacher. And he had a white childhood friend named Samuel who grew up, he was kind of one of the sons of the people who owned the plantation or the farm that he was a slave on, and this kid named Samuel grows up to actually become Nat's master, which is a very interesting dynamic there. And so he grows up and becomes a preacher and actually is hired to go around to other farms and preach to the slaves selected passages the owners wanted him to preach about obeying and things like that. And but the more that Nat sees the injustices that are happening all around him, and the more that he reads scripture, he's finding it impossible to reconcile these two things. And eventually he leads a violent revolt against the white owners across the South. And that's basically the movie in a nutshell. So Tim, I guess the place to start is really with Nate Parker himself. You can't escape it. The guy has his fingerprints over everything. He writes, he directs, he stars. What do you see as his strengths and weaknesses among the many talents that he brings to the film?
So, yeah, it's I think there's parts of the film that are very beautiful visually.
Mm-hmm.
I think his biggest strength's acting. And I'm not, you know, I'm not the guy that's usually talking about acting. I usually talk about story and plot elements and all that. But I think his acting is very surprising how good of an actor he is.
Mm-hmm.
He's able to say, one of the things he does is he says these scripture passages and that mean one thing to the slave owners and they mean something else to the slaves. And he's able to communicate, first off, that he's kind of torn up inside about that with his eyes, mm-hmm. which I'm like, really, it was very impressive.
Absolutely.
And then, but he is also able to kind of through tone, tell us what he's saying, in that. I thought that was very skillful. I don't know. It's hard for me to imagine another actor in that role. So I was very impressed with his acting. Yeah, as far as, you know, the story and stuff, not as impressed. It seemed like I had heard, not that story, but I'd heard similar stories before. It has a very brave heart kind of flow to it.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, like, his acting is definitely the strongest thing he brings to the film. And you're right, though. I mean, there are some beautiful imagery that he captures. You know, I'm thinking about, like, the corn that bleeds. And, you know, there's some just really striking symbols that I remember now after the fact. So I think that he definitely has some raw talent. And I think he has a promising future ahead. I mean, I'm excited to see what he does next.
It's interesting. I think some of that stuff, it's a little sophomoric. He's kind of heavy-handed with some of that imagery.
Right.
So, like, when Nat murders his master, and then he, and there's, like, a stained glass window.
Cross.
Yeah, of the cross. And I'm like, it's pitch black outside. That's not even possible, but whatever. But they have that going on, and it's, like, center of the frame. And I'm just like, that's really heavy-handed. I didn't feel like that was subtle enough for me, and I think he's young.
Yep.
And so I think there's elements of that looked seem a little contrived, but I think the strength would be when is definitely his acting and his ability to convey a tortured soul, mm-hmm. in the first parts of the film before he decides to go into vengeance mode.
Yes.
The idea of, like, being in conflict, internal conflict, he plays incredibly. And I would just, if you watch the first half of the movie, it would be worth it. And then just walk out.
That's exactly how I feel. I'm so glad you brought that up. Like, it really is a tale of two halves almost. Like, I think the first half is definitely his best work. You see, even as a director, as an actor, the complexity. And then when he makes that switch into his violent revolution, it just doesn't have the emotional payoff it needs. It seems really sudden, and it doesn't feel like it's an honest transformation. It just feels contrived. Yeah. So what did you think of the way that slavery was presented in the film compared to other films that deal with the subject, or just reality of what you know?
I think it's interesting that there was more than one version of slavery in that film, because you had different plantations that would have different practices.
Right.
And I'm a history major.
You are? Oh, yeah, good, because I'm horrible at history. So
well,
great.
And I did some work with, basically slave, looking at records, like different ledgers and records and stuff like that. And there are lots of accounts that would say there's different levels of brutality. I mean, it's all horrible, but they would have different levels of brutality on different, depending on who was running the slaves, you know? And so I think that is interesting. I also think, but the whole idea of running this thing by terror, I think, is what we're trying to get at. In that, I don't know if that, like, his, I don't see that his aim was to depict, you know, antebellum life in the South.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that. I think that we're pretty much, we don't need to be convinced that that's evil. I think there were some specifics where you had a slave having his teeth knocked out because he was trying to starve himself to death.
Probably the most disturbing scene in the film, for sure.
I don't necessarily doubt that that occurred.
But I thought it had a nice balance in the tone where it was graphic enough, but it wasn't too over the top. I thought he struck a pretty good balance with that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if he had to. I don't know how much. Yeah. It's interesting because I think he's looking. This is a problem that I have here.
Okay.
As I think that Parker wants us to draw conclusions about our contemporary situation here. But he wants, and so it's hard because he has to tell the story of an individual to do that. I think we can get a little bit lost in the plight of the individual, and it's hard for us to generalize, hey, these things are still occurring today.
Hmm.
Because we get more kind of, into the particularistic kind of nature of the story, and we forget, like, that there's universals that Parker's trying to draw us into. So I'm not, like, I don't know. I think it was a cruel, horrible thing.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody, I don't know a lot of people that are and have doubts about that. I think we come into the film with that, right?
Right.
And he just kind of reinforces what we think already.
You mentioned the levels of the owners and the brutality. And I think that's what's kind of fascinating to me is it's like you have these varying degrees of kindness, but they're all complicit in this thing, right? So, like, you have your stereotypical cruel people. You have this former best friend of Nat, who's actually pretty nice, I guess, as owners go. But there's never this thought of, like, hey, this was my friend growing up. Like, why is he calling me master now, right? It's
yeah, but I think, I guess... Yeah, so there's different levels of brutality as far as physical brutality.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, his Nats Master makes him do the worst thing there is, which is basically go and pacify his own people in the midst of their suffering. And he's like, hey, we're not, you know, we don't have a lot of food, so we're only giving them one meal a day. And they're kind of, they're sick. A lot of the slaves are sick and they're not doing well because there's a drought or whatever. And he has to go in and basically manipulate his own people in order to pacify them so that the slave owners can face less resistance.
So he's prostituting his faith, basically.
Well, his faith, but also, like, his identity. And so like, for him, that might be crueler, the most cruel thing there is. Mm-hmm. And his master doesn't seem to think twice about that. See, that's more powerful to me than, I don't think you need this device of, we talked about, they use rape as a justification Parker does this.
Yeah.
As a justification for these kind of like murderous rampage against all the slave holders. I don't think you need the rape to justify a murderous rampage. I think what you have is this cruelty is really the device that they start using, and they switch over to rape. And I think that's why that's so weird to me. I know rape is cruelty too. And I know that it occurred it occurred with some frequency from what we know historically. But I think it was interesting that that becomes the device.
Yeah.
Versus this corporate suffering. It's very corporate in the beginning, and then it kind of shifts to a very individual thing.
It's a good point. Yeah. So let's get to the heart of the thing and talk about this turning point that we already alluded to. So Nat's turn towards violence, I mean, he basically becomes convinced that God commissioned him to gather up an army and rise up and kill their oppressors. Like, this is a God-ordained mission. And we even see the camera zoom in on this open Bible on the table with this passage from the Old Testament where God is instructing the Israelites to kill every man, woman, and child. And this army is sort of like, I think, in Nat's eyes, like the new Israel. I mean, they're even like trying to take over the stronghold, which is called Jerusalem, to get to the weapons cache. So what are your thoughts, Tim, on how that played out and the morality about it? Is there a time where violence is necessary and can even be God ordained in modern times?
It's a simple question. It's a big question. I don't want to be a person that would say, by saying we should never be violent, justify that the violence of slavery. Does that make any sense? So, what does Malcolm X say? We talked about this before. He says, you mentioned, he said that, if basically resistance and the threat of violence is self-defense or something like that. Mm-hmm. I can't remember what
it is. It's a quote that's at the end of do the right thing. Yeah.
So there's some level of like, my entire people is enslaved, and to resist this is actually a holy thing to do. Hmm. And I don't know, like, I don't see, and I believe that. Can I go that far?
Okay.
So to resist evil and injustice and to take an act and to actively participate against it is good.
How far?
To the point where you're willing to lose your life. So that would be like my very peaceful, never had to deal with real oppression kind of view of things. But I also know in the Psalms, there's these Psalms of imprecation, and they're asking God, it's the people of God, asking God to do harm, physical, violent harm to the enemy. It's like, break the armor of the oppressor.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked a little bit about that before on this podcast, but I think there is something where it's hard to understand what that means if you haven't gone through oppression yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't want to pretend that I know. So that would be probably my first thought on that. The other thing would be, like, do I like revenge narratives that, like, you know, the Mel Gibson revenge narrative? No. I think it's thin. I think that you can feel that in the story. You go, this is so rich, until you get to this revenge narrative and you're like, oh, I know this story 100 times. I've seen this 100 times. It might as well be a Steven Seagal movie at this point.
It's a Hollywood trope, really. Yeah.
Yeah. That said, that might actually be more like the actual rebellion, right? Which is it might be a revenge narrative. I don't know. I wasn't there. We don't have we don't have tons of historical documents on there, and definitely not from sources that would be favorable to Nat Turner. So, but the rebellion itself, like, is, you know, were they fighting against injustice? Yes, absolutely. I don't know how I feel about breaking into people's houses and then axe murdering them.
Right.
Can I say Jesus would be into that? Probably not. But would I say, are they resisting evil and oppression? Yes. And are they trying to do something about it? Yes.
Yeah, I definitely agree with the tension. It's really hard because how can we... it's really easy to talk about nonviolence without having actually gone through something as horrific as that. Actually, we can't claim to have been oppressed of that nature. So it's easy to talk, basically. At the same time, it's hard because I feel like enemy love is a very radical teaching of Jesus, and I feel like it's central to the gospel. We believe that, like, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us, right? And God came in the form of Jesus to show us his nature. One of my favorite passages is Hebrews 1, which says that Jesus is the perfect imprint of God's nature, right? And I heard a pastor say once that if God looks in the mirror, he looks like Jesus. So what do you do with that? Because I think in the Old Testament, you get a lot fuzzier view of God. It's kind of like looking at God through a fog and this broken mirror, but Jesus is clear. It's almost impossible to come away with taking a really honest look at Jesus in the Gospels and come to any other conclusion that violence is off the table for Christ followers. And this is something Jesus modeled. I know that the people were expecting a violent revolt. They were wanting to overthrow Rome, and I think they were expecting right until the end that Jesus was going to do that. And yet he modeled this character of God, which involved dying on a cross for us, for his enemies. And this was something I think the early church understood too. They didn't fight in Rome's army. Back then, it was very frowned upon to participate in that. People were martyred for their faith. Whole families were taken to the Colosseum. They didn't fight back, right? They willingly went to their death, and they died not just willingly, but they died loving their enemies. And that's what, according to historians, is what started to change Rome from the inside out. So to me, this really gets to the heart of being a Christ follower. And I've talked about this before on the site. Actually, one of our very first podcasts, when I was still flying solo and you weren't here with us, was called The Marvel Universe Violent Heroes. So you can go check that out. It's like our first or second podcast that I was, where I was just like warming up. And I go through the whole, like, my argument for nonviolence from scripture. So you can check that out. But it's hard for me because I feel like one of the grossest things in Birth of a Nation is how these slave owners are cherry-picking scripture to justify evil, right? Just horrible. They're just plucking these verses about slaves obeying their masters to justify things that are beyond words. And I feel like it's equally offensive to cherry-pick the Bible to justify a theology of violence that says killing your enemies is okay. I feel like it's just as out of context with the whole sweep of scripture, of looking at the ark from beginning to end. And so all that to say, I just found the second half really disturbing. I feel like you said, killing your enemies is a really common trope. We're used to that. But slapping scripture on top of that is challenging to me.
So how do you I guess one of the things that, you know, like you give the metaphor of the Romans and the and the Christians. But I don't think the Romans are claiming Christ. So I think this gets really fuzzy. And because I think these plantation owners are like claiming that they're, you know, God's people, and that they know, and they're, you know, they know scripture and they're doing the will of God.
That's interesting.
And I think it gets really fuzzy because at some point you go, well, they're both, and you see this in the, they said, Nat Turner wouldn't even say cherry picking. He said, for every verse that I see that supports this position of the plantation owner, I see another one that supports us. I think maybe that's very true. What he said in the film. Which is,
I would argue outside of the life of Jesus, yes.
Yes.
But it's almost impossible within Jesus' life and teachings.
Right. Do I think of Jesus as a nonviolent passive resistance? Yes. He's nonviolent to the point of he doesn't want to kill. He's not nonviolent in the sense of he's not willing to give his life.
Absolutely. Right.
To violence.
Yep.
And so what I would say is like this idea of willingness to give up your life is actually present in the film. Right? I mean, it's very present in the film. I also think there's a willingness to kill in the film that I don't see as reflecting who Jesus is.
Right.
So
but that's an interesting point. I didn't think about that, about how, as compared to a pagan culture like Rome or even Egypt, when the Israelites were in slavery, you basically have fellow Christians. And you could argue that Jesus was harshest with his own people, right? If it was a time for Jesus to get really mad, the only time he ever seemed to do it was against the Pharisees and the people who were basically misusing scripture for their own gain.
So that's all this is very interesting. Do you want to, have we talked about like the origin of the title yet?
No, go ahead.
Is that all right?
Yeah.
So Birth of a Nation, this isn't the first film named that. If you're a film buff, you'll know that like the first, it's not the first feature-length film, but it's one of the first feature-length films, is A Birth of a Nation by D.W. Griffith.
From 1915.
1915, so 101, oh, actually probably 100 years before the production of this film. And it's known for, it's got its problems. Let's put it that way. It's known as being kind of a cinematic masterpiece from the sense, from a production standpoint. It's fairly amazing for its time. So it does things like parallel timelines. through cuts, which is like never been done up until that point. There's a lot of scenes in it that where basically people still lift his techniques for different scenes, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like this epic film. The problem is it's based on a book called The Klansman.
Uh-oh.
And I know here it comes, right? And which is, and it's very pro-KKK.
The film is?
The film is, yeah. And it looks at the Klan as being these heroic figures who rescue Southern women from, you know, murderous blacks who want who also maybe also want to rape them. So like the rape thing is in Birth of a Nation too, and the Klan will come like white knights and come rescue those folks. In fact, that's in the very end scene of that. It featured actors in blackface, and it is incredibly controversial for those reasons. What's so scary about that film is because it was so well made and it was so well attended that you saw a resurgence of the Klan as a result of this film.
Wow.
And you saw the Klan got to the biggest point that it ever was in the 20s. So like right after this film. So this film was directly responsible for recruiting people to the Klan. In fact, sometimes the Klan would sit outside of the theater when the theater was getting out from here and recruit right out of that.
Holy smokes.
And so what Parker has done is he's appropriated this idea of the Birth of a Nation.
He's like reclaimed the title. That's what he said, right, in the interview. Yeah.
Yeah. And so he's saying, you know, he's reclaiming it and he's saying, no, it's not about this. It's about this. And I think with some of, you know, I'm trying to understand like, why would he create rape scenes within this film, especially knowing his own background, that he has to know that's going to come out at some point. And I think it's because you have rape scenes in the original Birth of a Nation, and it's...
And to be fair, there isn't actually a rape scene in the movie.
It's implied.
Yes, implied.
And it is also implied in Birth of a Nation.
Ah, okay.
It said, oh, these debased blacks are going to come in and rape the white women. And this is like the opposite, which would say these debased white men in power are going to rape the black women.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to use the black women to do these things. And so he's really, it's just a parallel to the original Birth of a Nation. He's just flipping the script. So in that sense, it's kind of brilliant. It makes sense to me why he would do it if that's his rationale. If he's taking the original one and reappropriating it, he's going to flip it around and say, you know, this is how... I mean, some of the stereotypes that we're dealing with today are a direct result of that first film.
Hmm.
So like the idea that... yeah, these stereotypes of the black male come from Birth of a Nation, the film.
Well, let's talk about that, because did you see the TV spots for Birth of a Nation? Because it was interesting. They explicitly, in the advertising campaign, brought the Black Lives Matter movement into the trailer. Like, they literally spliced the movie Birth of a Nation with people marching in 2016 carrying Black Lives Matter signs.
Because Parker wants this to be a call to uprising. I don't think but, calling people to murder people.
But is there a little bit of danger drawing a comparison? I mean, what message can you possibly take away from the film other than that at some times when you're oppressed, you have to take matters into your own hands? I mean...
So I imagine, because this is where like we really are going to have a hard time.
Yeah.
Because we have white history like crazy, right? And so like if you even look at hip-hop and you look up hip-hop and look up Nat Turner. And you're going to see references over and over and over and over and over again to Nat Turner, including Lecrae, which I'm sure you like Lecrae, right?
Someone. And rap isn't really my thing.
Not your thing.
Yeah.
But you're going to see these references over and over again because Nat Turner is the guy that resisted. Nat Turner is the guy who said, no, this can't, we're not going to take this just sitting down. We're not going to take this. And he is over and over again, the guy that resisted. And even though he died, he resisted. So he's very much like the Mel Gibson character. He's like William Wallace.
Right.
For within a lot of folks in black history. He's like, no, we didn't just take this. We fought. And so I think there's something to that. If you look at the way history has been appropriated by the dominant culture, you've got all these awful, racist, miserable folks that are heroes in the culture.
Mm.
And so it's so like, who do you go to? And a lot of times, you know, like, cause we look at net turn, oh, it's despicable. But I would say for some folks, it'd be like, no, this Nat Turner, the person Nat Turner, the symbol of Nat Turner, maybe, mm-hmm. maybe not actual Nat Turner, becomes, he becomes this icon of being willing to fight against the power, even if you know that that power is stronger than you are. So I think that he's pulling the iconography of him, which is very aware. The black community is very aware of that. Mm-hmm. We aren't so much. We're like, who is this guy?
Right. Right.
But very much aware of it. Like we might be aware of Abe Lincoln. Is it Nat Turner is Nat Turner fought. So much so that, you know, it makes it into Roots. I mean, the film, the Alex Haley film or whatever.
Miniseries.
And a bunch of other things. But definitely on the, definitely right, kind of the spirit of the times would be, I think a lot of folks would be aware of Nat Turner as the man who was willing to stand up.
So you're a history buff. Correct me if I'm wrong. I was thinking about this. Is it true to say that the struggle for civil rights hit its strongest churn with Martin Luther King Jr. and his work in the 60s. Is that fair to say? Like, what I'm, and this is again me being terrible at history, but I look back and you have these violent uprisings, you have the Civil War, you have Abe Lincoln, but slavery persists throughout that, right? And then you have this like civil form of slavery, which is separate drinking fountains and not being able to vote and things
Jim
like
Crow
that.
And, yeah.
Right. Uh-huh. And then Martin Luther King Jr. comes on the scene, specifically nonviolent revolution, and it feels like that's when the dominoes start to fall. Is that fair to say, or is that mischaracterizing?
Like historically, like when... No, I think that like he's influenced by Thoreau and he's influenced by Gandhi. So the idea of a civil disobedience has been tried out in India already.
Ah.
So this idea of civil disobedience, I think... So that's where you see the civil rights movement as being crucial. But there's also some elements that couldn't have happened in Nat Turner's day, which is you have TV.
True.
So when you turn a fire hose on a bunch of kids and you put some dogs loose on them in Birmingham, you don't have you. It's not going to have the impact in Nat Turner's day that it would have in King's day.
Yep.
But that said, like I do think King is definitely like a nonviolent resistance kind of guy. But he's like the dude's got a PhD. The guy's a he's a theologian. He's like, well, I mean, Nat Turner is this guy who learned, you know, he's learning how to read, but he's a man of one book, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's hard to compare the two. I think they both knew what they knew. I think Nat Turner's world is probably very small compared to King's world. But yeah, so I don't know. As far as like the civil rights movement, I think what you had was within that. And so, and Black Lives Matter would say, well, hey, this thing wasn't fully successful.
Right. Sure.
In fact, it didn't achieve what it was supposed to achieve.
Absolutely.
And a lot of people would say, oh, that's probably true. But I think within the civil rights movement, what you had was not only did you have black leaders that rose up, you also had, especially church leaders but you also had the press and the ability to, get the white moderates to finally go, wait a minute, this ain't right.
And Selma really depicts that about, you know, you just have white people across the country watching this on TV and suddenly they're actually want to go and be a part of this.
Right.
Yeah.
But see, that's like national politics. You get so, you know, and so that's very different than like Nat's not going to be able to even.
He's on a farm in the middle of nowhere.
In the
basically.
Middle of nowhere, is he going to be able to access a newspaper? You know what I mean? So I don't know if it's a fair comparison to say he should have done it like King did it.
Yeah.
I'd say probably not. I'd say I don't know what else, what were his options. To basically live out his life and like the reality is 1831, we don't have all kinds of documentation on who Nat actually was.
Yeah, it's tough. I can't help but think about the Israelites though, back when they were slaves in Egypt. I mean, again, you have a very primitive culture. They had no power and they had to wait 400 something years for God to raise up Moses to come and initiate God's rescue of them, right? So for literally four generations of people, they just, all they know is slavery and they die and they ask themselves, where is God? Now, should they have revolted? Should they have taken matters in their own hands, or are we supposed to wait? That's really tough. Again,
so King is like nonviolent, but he writes the book, Why We Can't Wait. And so this idea of like, well, just wait.
Yeah.
What a white idea that is. I mean,
right.
Just wait. You know, while I have a full belly and I'm benefiting from your suffering, just wait.
That's true.
And I don't even know. Yeah, I don't know how. I think there are. You can draw some comparisons, but I think it's hard. I don't want to like go direct. Well, we saw this with the Israelites, therefore this. I don't think that's fair to hear. But I would say like this idea of uprising is not a bad idea. The idea of like living, because I think at the heart of it, there's this idea of justice.
Yep.
And that to be passive and just accept injustice is immoral.
Mm-hmm.
I think this film really captures his struggle in the first half of that, the immorality that he cannot live with, that is passively, in fact, participating in the subjugation of his own people is immoral and he can't do it. The second half, I think, fails to have the same power.
Yes. Yeah, and I think even the climax of the first half, which is one of the most powerful scenes in the movie, where a white man comes and wants to be baptized, and he's willing to baptize him, knowing that probably this is going to have severe consequences, which it does. And even in the midst of suffering for that, there's this smile on his face because he knows, you know, that's power. That's the power of resisting and being willing to lay your life down while at the same time. Yeah. So final thoughts on the film. If you had to sum up your take on things in a minute or two, go ahead.
I think that it's a good film just to, because it's bringing good conversation here. If you feel like I don't know what to say. I think it's good. It brought about good conversation. I think it is kind of degrades toward the end of the film into a revenge narrative, which is not very overly sophisticated. But I think the first part of the film, if you want to see some good acting, just if you want to say, check out Nate Parker and see this dude can act, I think this is a really good film to watch. If you want to get into this dialogue about how do we fight, you know, injustice, and then maybe this is a good film to watch. But I think he's seeking a response. This film seeks a response. It's supposed to agitate you. And I think it accomplishes that. Did you feel agitated watching the film?
Absolutely. You can't not have a reaction one way or the other, for sure.
Yeah, so I think he's successful in that way. Do I think it's going to win any... Do I think it's going to win the Academy Award for anything? No. No,
letter grade, no. If you had to narrow it down?
I think it's a solid B.
Mm-hmm.
I would see it. Like, I'd pay money to see it. But I'm not... Yeah, I think it really suffers at the end.
I completely agree. I think we're on the same page with this. I mean, the first half, you're talking about a solid A-minus movie. You see this raw talent of Nate Parker, especially when it comes to his acting, but even some of his directing. There's some really cool, adventurous, stylistic choices he makes, and then this revolution comes, and I think from there you're more into B-minus territory. So if you take the average of that, you're right in the straight-up B arena. I mean, it's definitely worth seeing. I agree with Tim. You can probably wait for DVD, but I wouldn't miss it. It's an interesting movie. It'll have you talking and thinking about it for a long time. I hope you enjoyed our conversation, and it's always a pleasure, Tim. So yep. Keep the faith, my friends. We will see you next time.